I'm gonna start a plant, where'd you say, upstate New York or someplace?
Mm.
Okay. One of the disclosures that I should have to make, when I think about siting the plant and all of the other factors that go into it, is what impact will climate change or might climate change have on my business? And I think that should be required disclosure, not just in boilerplate, or in fact, not in boilerplate, but in some meaningful fashion.
And Peter, you and I were talking about this earlier, about the ecosystem in which companies operate today is very different than in Richard Nixon's time. So take us down that road. What were you telling me when, you know, just to come to Bob's point, he's talking about disclosure and this should happen. But let's just, you know, stick with the theme that I'm a really nasty Robert Barron type guy, and I want to make, you know, David Bradley very profitable, and I want to pollute because I think that, I mean, just explain to me what happens in the modern world today.
So today, what you do is seen by everybody. It's social media shines a light on your company and your behavior. You cannot be beautiful and clean in California and destructive in Nigeria. Your brand, your culture, your image is actually going to be perceived as either a partner or a predator. And that's really good. And that, what I've seen in dealing with extractive industries, with ag industries, with energy industries, is that they're really well aware that their license to operate is affected by their behavior, and they can't pretend they behave in a certain way in some place and give a sales pitch in another place. It just doesn't work anymore.
So they're all on it, they're all talking about it. So this notion that I could go into it, that actually I'm penalized very quickly. So getting back to bottom line, I mean, I don't have to be a moral player worried about the environment, it's bad for the bottom line.
It's definitely, in the way I see it, and the companies that we work with, from Walmart to Starbucks to different extractive industries, to ag industries, to fisheries, they all understand a few basic things. Number one, the customers today are really interested. Number two, the employees are really interested. Number three, their supply chain has got to be secured, and environmental damage does not secure a supply chain if you're trying to sell fish. And if you overfish, you don't have something to sell.
Right.
And so number four, that affects your bottom line. And that's really the transition that's taking place. Customers, employees, and shareholders are all concerned about it, and that is an extraordinarily shift that's taken place just in the last decade, and it's accelerating. And Paris really underscored it. Paris was the aha moment that said, we really need to focus on this, and so I think anybody that's here that's working in the environmental space is really overwhelmed by opportunity.
I can see in Bob Rubin's eyebrows that he has a two-finger.
Peter, you're probably right. You know a ton more about this than I do. But I still have a job, actually. And because of my job, I spend a lot of time with companies. Mm-hmm. And I have some consulting relationships with investors, and I have a fair bit of, I sort of live in that world. Peter, I am a real environmentalist. I believe in it fervently. But I don't think that there's, I think we should be where you are. But it isn't what I hear, at least, when I have some advisory relationships with some very large investing organizations, and I don't hear them talk very much about this, which is why I guess I emphasize matters like disclosure,
mm-hmm.
because that would actually put it right in front of them in a form that they would have to take cognizance of it.
So Leisha knows the answer because she's at EY and manages lots of companies, and you know what the real truth is. So what is the answer here?
All right, I'll give it to you. So we work, obviously, with leading companies around the world who are focused on this, and I think at this point, leading companies, you know, they're all purpose-led, they've embraced the triple bottom line, people, planet, and profit, and I think the same three drivers have been there for a long time around going green, and that is, it's a way to make money, save money, and reduce risk, and those are the three main reasons, and we see a lot of companies making money in green innovation. We see them saving money. That's why zero waste has become so popular, and you know, companies that are embracing the circular economy, I would put under, you know, efficiencies and saving money. And I think the third one is probably, for many companies, the most important, and that is managing risk. And that risk can be in the form of brand and reputational, which for a professional services firm, that's what we deal with. You know, we have to be on this. But there's other risks. There's supply chain risks.
So brand and reputation is what you're working on?
Well,
mostly with
internally
companies.
For EY.
So can they fake
the
it?
Most.
Can they fake brand and
you
reputation?
You can greenwash, but your employees are going to figure it out pretty quickly. Mm. But I think the other risk areas other than supply chain would be resource scarcity. We see a lot of that, especially around water. And also even extreme weather events. You know, we are now planning for extreme weather events and business continuity issues. And making sure we can find our people, since we're a professional services organization, you know, when the next Sandy comes through or the next hurricane, you know, we got to be sure that our people are accounted for and can still work.
So, Lisa, let me drill down again just to wrestle with the topic for a second. If you were to go and advocate as you do and sort of counseling it, I guess the other question is there too much environmental? I mean, what is the balance, right? What's this pendulum swinging between being this dark, nefarious character who pays no attention to just paying too much? How do you get the right balance of an environmental ethic built into the corporate culture and into your investment decisions? I mean, is it just, when Bob talks about disclosure, is there sort of a standard out there? Because I hear a lot of talk about environmentalism in the world, but to me it sounds like I don't know where the hard choices are.
Well, one of the other responsibilities I have is I work globally at EY trying to harmonize our sustainability reporting. So that's really tough. There's a lot of different frameworks out there. There's GRI, there's CDP, there's IIRC.
You sound like the Pentagon.
Alphabet soup of reporting. But it is really driving transparency and also the ability to compare across companies. You know, what is their environmental record, what progress are they making? Have they made greenhouse gas reduction target goals? But also I think once you start working on environmental sustainability, it quickly becomes much more broad in terms of, you know, diversity and inclusiveness is a big part of sustainability at a professional services firm. So you find yourself, I think, getting outside of just the green space.
Bob, I can feel your vibe.
No, I think this is all great, and I think things that people, that companies do that are terrific, and it's wonderful, and the more they do it, the better, and the more you're right, the better. But there's a moral hazard problem in this, and I'll tell you what it is. To the extent that that takes our attention away from what I at least think is really the key with respect to at least climate change, the thing I'm most concerned, that I think could be an adverse rather than a positive effect of all this. We have got to have pricing of carbon, in my opinion. And if we can't, and to the extent that companies and those involved in the environmental movement feel that they're accomplishing their purposes this way, and therefore take the pressure off with respect to trying to get pricing, that I think is a negative. Secondly, we should have a green GDP. Now, it won't be replace existing GDP, but with the externalities involved, you could have a parallel GDP.
What is a green GDP? Tell me what that means.
A green GDP is very simple. The factory you mentioned before,
right.
So it produces X, whatever it is. And that goes into GDP. But it may be creating terrible environmental problems
right. And
not reflecting GDP. There should be a measure of GDP that captures those externalities, that captures those effects. And if you had that, that might
also... If anybody is tweeting, that's a cool thing to tweet. I just want to sort of highlight that for a moment.
That could also have effect. And I'll tell you another one, Stephen, and I think this is a really, really important one. Our country is facing dangerous and unsustainable intermediate and long-term fiscal... And we have an unsustainable and... dangerous intermediate and long-term fiscal trajectory. But what's left out of that fiscal trajectory are what I think are going to be immense additional costs for emergency measures to deal with the tremendous effects that I at least believe climate change is likely to have, and the adaptation costs of climate change. The federal governments have to absorb these, and they're not in our fiscal numbers. If they were reflected in our fiscal numbers, that too might create a different political dynamic.
Peter? We're getting near the end, but we're going to go to the audience for a few questions. But I want to ask you to
I got to respond.
Yeah, I want to take you down this journey of how screwed are we right now in the environment? Like, you know, you hear about the coral reefs being bleached, you hear about fisheries disappearing, species being eroded, you know, the increase of violent weather and the impacts there, and you know, I think 20 years ago that. We were debating all of these things and we had a lot of deniers. Now we're in the middle of a lot of disasters that are here. So are we just cooked?
Okay, so I have, there are three aspects to the answer to that. The first is that we are in the age of adaptation. And in other words, this is not something we're going to avoid. We're in the middle of it. And it's going to become more extreme. And you can see it right now. You can see it in the Sahel. You can see the impact of drought and devastation and the movement of people into Europe and the impact of forced immigration.
So the answer is we are screwed.
We're right in the middle of it. Yeah. No, it's not. We're right in the middle of it, number one. Number two, you go to the South Pacific, ocean level rising, acidification. Communities and nations are really faced with a real and present danger. It's not something that might happen. It is happening right now. Biggest storms, the greatest threats that these countries have ever experienced. So right now, we're in the middle of it. That's the truth. The good news is that we are extraordinarily adaptable. And the good news is that we do have tools available to actually make important adjustments and changes. We've got to embrace them. We need to think about how do we secure ecological diversity, because the truth is that genetic diversity is the most important tool we have to changing environmental factors. I mean, the ability of salmon to adjust to changes in temperature, the ability of coral to make adjustments is due to their genetic diversity. So we've got to secure our basic tools, number one. We have to also put a value, as Bog was saying, it's called kind of a natural capital protocol. When anybody in this audience thinks about your personal wealth, you think about your income and you think about your assets. Nations don't do that. So a nation that has a massive, beautiful, productive coral reef does not think about that as an asset that has value. It's just out there. When they think about a forest, it's just out there. It's actually a water factory. And a coral reef is a protein factory. We need to put those into our national accounting systems so we have a value on it, because if we value it, we'll protect it. We'll understand when all of a sudden our imports exceed our exports because we've destroyed our ecological foundation. So those are just kind of the simple, you know, truths. The last reason why I think that we actually have a reason to be optimistic, it goes to kind of an encounter I had in Iceland. Iceland is, I think, the best example of a nation that actually has built its economy around the theme of sustainability. 100% renewable energy, 100% renewable fishery, and they actually are focusing on how do you use their resources extraordinarily efficiently. And so they've demonstrated they could do this. We had our board meeting in Iceland 2 weeks ago, and I was talking to a 14-year-old boy, and he said to me, I want to tell you about my eighth grade project. And he told me about his eighth grade project, ag, sustainability, perverse incentives, all the things that I'm learning about this year. And this is a kid in eighth grade. So the most important part of the good news is that every responsible business, every responsible school in every country is actually talking about this. And so we actually are in the midst of a innovation boom that is being stimulated by climate change and stimulated by ecosystem implosion. So that's the good news, and I think we will get through it. It's just gonna have some harsh times.
Alicia?
Well, and as you're talking, I totally agree with you. This aligns perfectly with the EY Megatrends 2016 report that we just came out with, and it was about disruptive innovation and how it will hopefully, or can, I should say, lead to a resource-rich planet versus a resource-scarce planet. We can do it. And the price on carbon is really critical, and I think that came out of Paris pretty loud and clear. And that's why we have 1,000 companies right now that are already pretending as if a carbon tax is in place. And they're preparing for it, and that's why they're mitigating their greenhouse gases.
So final question before I go to the audience. Bob Rubin just suggested a green GDP is something I hadn't heard before, but maybe because I'm illiterate in these subjects. But I think when you look at the policy side of this and you look at the power of the private sector, which we're talking about today, I'm interested, you both have said that a lot is moving in the right direction. But so if gravity takes us forward and a lot, and Conservation International, by the way, great annual report, lots of great pictures, all of it. If everything is going that direction, then maybe do we not need to worry about this? And I guess I always want to focus my mind on the parts of the puzzle that aren't getting fixed. And so what would you do that's not being done today, real short form, that you think would have a substantive effect on what we're seeing in the environment today? What are our blind spots that need more attention? Peter?
So there are two. One is a price on carbon is absolutely essential, because if you have a price on carbon...
Have you been to DC lately?
It China's putting a price on carbon.
Okay, so they're putting, so is that enough?
The market signal, Europe's going to put a price on carbon.
So if President Trump is going to put a price on carbon?
I don't want to imagine that situation.
Yeah, okay. Well,
so the market is going to go in that direction.
Okay.
So number one, there will be a price on carbon, I believe. And I think that it's not going to be instantaneous. It will take a decade. It's a long haul, but I believe it will happen. And I think once you do that, you've unleashed a huge amount of resource that is a financial resource that is important for the second part of the answer. And the second part of the answer is that there are about 30% of this earth is under the control of tribal and traditional peoples. Just think about that. Forests. 30% of the solution for climate change comes from stopping deforestation and keeping forests that can absorb carbon. The majority of those trees are owned by traditional peoples. They should be compensated for keeping their forests intact. And so if you have a market mechanism that compensates owners and communities that do the right thing, you're actually going to have a major step forward. And so those are the optimistic and I think also realistic opportunities in front of us.
Leisha.
Okay, three things. You already said two of them.
Fast
price
form.
On carbon, valuing natural capital.
Oh, so you're agreeing with two of them, so you're only adding one?
I'm only adding one.
Okay.
Keeping it short. The third one, I think, is more financial disclosure. We need some reporting guidelines about disclosing climate risk. What is the risk to your business of climate change?
Bob, if Hillary Clinton wins, would you go back as Secretary of Treasury?
unless they increase the compensation immensely. rather than answer, since I agree with everything that's been said, except
so add a Ruben Zinger for me.
No, I agree with everything said, except I think they're wrong. I think they're wrong in their optimism. I do a lot of public speaking. I do a lot of panels. Nobody ever asked me about climate change. Tom Steyer is an enormously good friend of mine, and I talk a lot about this. I agree with Tom that in the world I live in, almost everybody agrees there's climate change and it has human causation. I think almost nobody has internalized the existential threat. And until that's internalized, I don't think they're going to put it in the place that it needs to be in their priorities to then try to exercise political pressure to get something done. Now, 10 years from now, Peter, that's a long time. Yeah, Hank Paulson said to me the other day, I don't know if it's right or not, but it's what Hank said, that if you look back at what the climate scientists said 10 years ago, it's all happening much more quickly.
Right.
So the 10 years, Peter, that you're using that seems to make you
comfortable. We're cooked.
Makes me uncomfortable.
So on that, yeah,
just to add one thing, I think that I actually don't believe that we're cooked, and I do think it's going to take a decade to make the transition. But I also think that what we should realize, this is a U.S.-centric discussion. Leave the United States and then start talking to China, to India, to the island nations, to European nations, and most other countries around the world are not waiting. They're acting. And so I think the US will catch up. If we don't catch up, we're going to be left behind. But the train has left the station, and the world is looking at a carbon price and a carbon market. And that's why I'm optimistic.
It's already working in British Columbia. State of Washington's going to have it on the ballot. Reggie, California. I mean, and China's flipping the switch in 2017. It's coming.
Fast.
Could I ask Peter a quick question?
Yeah, sure.
Is China not still building a lot of coal plants?
China has a 20-year strategy that is part of the NRDC strategy of a 5% reduction of CO2 per year. And they're actually implementing it. And so the perspective I get from dealing with the government of China is actually moving rapidly in the right direction, and I believe that they believe they're going to accelerate that pace.
Because their emissions are peaking very soon.
And they're committing to offsets, a very, very aggressive strategy for
carbon. See, this is the real world. This is we promised you a kind of real world discussion of what the equities are and how hard they're to get. But I want to come to the audience real quick for just a few minutes. James Walton is hiding in the very, very back, but I promise you the first question. So, what insights do you have, sir?
Jeez. I'll give you a second. So, Ben, given all this talk about corporate business relations, I'm wondering, in the U.S., and because we are all here, what is the chance of, how does business accelerate change within the political sector? I mean, is there, are there, you would think through the benefits, through the fact that business is good for, or green is good for business, are they not going to, will that not be adopted or accelerated through the political spectrum, or where will political change happen?
And let me just piggyback on James's question for a moment. Thanks, pal. sure, I'm going to hear it from you later. But millennials, I went to James because of millennials. Is there a generational thing going on in terms of expectations, the demands? So just to piggyback on this question of business and accelerating politics, the millennials, we don't have any millennials up here, but are they a driver seeing it differently? Peter?
So 51% of CI staff are millennials. And they are the leaders in the organization.
I think, what, it's 75% at the Atlantic, right?
So there you go. You're way ahead.
You'll catch up.
But the point is that the person, the woman that runs our climate strategy is 28 years old, and her team is younger, and they are driving the effort. So I think the number one, millennials are really essential and important. Number two, just kind of getting to the answer to the question of business and what can they do,
right?
I believe the business behavior will be driven by consumer awareness. And what's interesting about millennials is that millennials that have children go from being kind of interested in environmental stuff to really interested. And so that's the second thing. And the third thing is, you know what companies could do that they don't do? Despite all the companies that talk about sustainability, and they have sustainability officers, and they focus on these issues, none of them put their lobbyists to work in Washington driving change in the political side.
Bob?
Peter, my impression is I'm much less optimistic than others here. That business is going to start thinking very green, but let's leave that aside. But you're right about that. And I think one thing, James, that could really change it, if the SEC would do what they should do, and are really obligated by law to do, which is to require disclosure, and not just boilerplate, but real disclosure, that then puts pressure on the managers. And if the managers feel the pressure, and they're going to have to adjust the way they do their businesses. And I think there's a possibility, and this may be unrealistic. I sometimes get too optimistic about things, but although it's not obvious, not always evident, I suppose. But it's possible that if they're then having to pay a very big price in terms of the adjustments they have to make, then maybe they will get, at least some of them will get involved politically and try to push for carbon prices and other actions like support for technology that government could provide.
Jude, I was going to go to you, but I'm going to go to my chairman real quickly. Yeah, and then you understand that, right? This is David Bradley. Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, Jude. Okay.
You know,
we're going to fast form, and then David, and then Stuart. You get to ask a question whenever you want. So.
I was also going to mention.
I want Stuart to buy the coral reefs around the world, and we'll be okay. Just go ahead.
First of all, I'm very, very. Grateful that I'm here, you know, hearing how business is moving towards the direction of sustainability. Let me introduce myself. My name is Jude Chizome Rundu. I am originally from Nigeria. I had the privilege to study at Green Mountain College, where I majored in sustainable business with minor in environmental policy. Sustainability is
Jude,
like
you should be on this panel. Yeah. So short form question.
The question is, as the world is moving from mitigation to adaptation, how can business shift towards adaptation strategy without undermining their profit bottom line? Because that is very, very
critical. Look, that should have been my first question. So thank you. Quick hand, Peter.
Well, first of all, they've got to do both, right? I mean, we all have to do both. We've got to be thinking every government, every business, mitigation, how do you reduce impact, adaptation, how do you respond to it. And the adaptation piece is really essential for those that are involved in supply chain concerns. I mean, you cannot survive if you don't adapt, and so that's why it's really important for the corporate sector, and they are doing it. I mean, Walmart is deeply involved in that, Starbucks deeply involved in it, many companies really concerned about this, and so they get that there's a hammer coming at them, they've got to be able to ensure resilience. Mm. And so I don't, but part of it is just becoming aware of the issue, and also once you're aware of the issue, actually having the tools to respond. And what most countries and businesses don't have are those tools. And so the job of universities and NGOs is to help design those tools.
Any quick, Leisha? Go faster. No, David Bradley, can you please hand our chairman the microphone? Post haste, yes. David?
Can I just point out that when you're not here as an audience, I never get this kind of deference from Steve. This is all theater going on right now.
You were a supporter of Richard Nixon in elementary school.
Can I just see a show of hands? How many would rather Richard Nixon than the current Republican nominee become president of the United
States?
Well,
I also want to note that Richard Nixon established the Environmental Protection Agency, right? So it is perfectly on target here. David?
So Bill Gates came to Washington a year ago, and I heard him make an argument. You all understand the argument better than I'm able to repeat the argument. But he thought this all reduced to a math question. And the math question included a calculation of, well, how quickly can we be making the reforms you're talking about, while at the same time there was growth in population and higher levels of consumption as there's a greater and greater middle class. In his view, the math isn't close. We will not solve this problem through any kind of conservation. And therefore, what he was in D.C. to do was to propose that he'd put in a certain amount of money, but he needed the U.S. government to put in a lot more money. And the only way this gets solved is technological breakthroughs such that people don't have to sacrifice to live at a higher standard. Is nobody at table argued with him, kind of a fool's errand. Is the environmental community all of one view that he's just wrong on this, or is there a debate going on? Bob?
I'm not in the environmental community. Could I make one comment in response to what Bill Gates says? He may be right and he may be wrong. I don't think he can afford to take the risk that he's right.
Great. Last comments, two of you. Leisha?
I would agree. I mean, the only other thing I wanted to bring up was the role of the shareholder. And at the EY Center for Board Matters, we actually track each proxy season what shareholder proposals are coming through. And environmental proposals are now in the mainstream. Shareholders are asking for greenhouse gas reporting, climate risk reporting, forget the third one, but environmentally related. And so I think that's also going to push things a little bit.
Can I ask you one quick, 10 years ago, did your job exist at EY?
No.
When was your job established?
8 years ago.
So is that pretty much consistent with industry that 8 years ago, the cycle of awareness?
Yeah, I felt like one of the pioneers 8 years ago.
Interesting.
I've changed my reporting line 3 times, which goes to show you that, you know, your impact is all over the
organization. Has it gone higher and higher and more direct, or are they burying you in the company?
Right now I'm buried, but I'm soon to be moving that way.
Cool. You heard it here. Peter?
So Bill Gates is obviously brilliant, but he's not always right. And about 10 years ago or so, I had a conversation. I live in Seattle. About 10 years ago, I had a conversation with him about the role of ecosystems in agriculture. And they basically determined that their ag program was going to focus on seed technology, agricultural farming technology, and how to get the product to market. And this was for the smallholder farmers, 200 million of them, in sub-Saharan Africa. And when I talk about environment, we don't do environment. That's not really our interest. 3 years later, we went back to the foundation and said, so what happens to that smallholder farmer when there's no more water, or there's no more soil organisms, or there's no more pollinators? And his response was, actually, we have not thought about that. And so we designed a program, CI designed a program with Gates Foundation called Vital Signs, to measure the contribution that ecosystems make for agricultural productivity. And it's now throughout sub-Saharan Africa. Very important breakthrough. On the issue of energy, the big challenge we have with this intense siloed focus on climate change is that if all we do is have cheap, affordable, and clean energy, we will reduce a big part of the CO2 issue. We won't solve the problem because 30% of it comes the way we farm and the way we forest. But more importantly, we're not going to change the way we take care of our fisheries, our watersheds, our forests, or our soils. And so we cannot just be looking at this as a mathematical solution. We need to think of it as a value solution also, which means we really have a job ahead of us in terms of awareness and education. Why does humanity depend upon nature to thrive? And if we don't do that, we're really cooked.
And on that note, I'm going to say thank you to everyone. I will say this before we close, before we enjoy cheese and wine and bourbon and all the fun things at Aspen Ideas here. I started with the Nixon frame on purpose to help deliver the notion that there's been an evolution between that time and where we are now. And then in fact, the DNA of businesses and how they operate, at least in the United States, seem to be changing. I would challenge you that I sense that less in India, I sense that less in Malaysia, I sense that less in other parts of the developing world that are hungry to get ahead and not as environmentally sensitive. And I would also say that Bob Rubin's cynicism is a very good corrective on when you think about the tough choices that need to be made. And I went through both the Walton Foundation and your annual report today at Conservation. There are tough choices out there. You can't do everything in mega, you know, and you focused on four priorities that are fascinating. But when you begin looking at metaphors and examples and frames of folks that are trying to sort of move that needle forward in a compelling way, it's not all just sentiment. It's hard choices, it's steps that are taken. And I think tonight, folks, I heard at least four or five things that I hadn't heard before that actually could be done and could change the game a little bit. So I want to thank you very much, Peter Seligman, Lisha John, Robert Rubin. Thank you, Rob Walton, and James, thanks for answering my question for us. Well, thank you all very much for joining us. And don't forget the virtual reality room and go put on a set of those headphones. Thank you all.